he turned up with his armed bodyguard. You know, the guy had a pistol inside his jacket.
But obviously there were names that were being cropped up and players coming in that wasn't on my radar.
You're joking. He's rubbish. I don't want him. And he's like, well, I've seen him at the training ground today and he's signing.
I said, well, you're running this club into the ground. And I remember him coming back and saying, well, I own the club, so what I do goes.
Yeah, it was very obvious at that point that there was a sick club.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to season 3 of The Circus Upstairs.
My name is James Masters, a content Leighton Orient supporter and journalist.
I wondered what you were going to say there. I thought you'd revert back to long suffering.
Well, I did suffer watching Lincoln City steal a 1-0 win at Brisbane Road last night. And I have to say, that was hard going, Matt.
I think if people in the future come across this podcast and listen to you saying that you're content or last season that you were happy, they'll just be like, what crazy blip in Orient's history was this recorded in?
I think, how many games did I win? 5?
I'm Matt Simpson. That is all I'm going to say. I'm not going to mention the book. That's a complete waste of time. All those other times I mentioned it, it's had a detrimental effect. So I got nothing else to say about myself. That's it.
Christmas coming up, surely you should be plugging the book.
Anyway, my intention is that, like The Return of the Jedi, Godfather Part 3, Blade Trinity, and of course, Police Academy 3 Back in Training, this season is going to be significantly worse than its predecessors.
I thought you were going to say Shrek 3, and I was going to say, hang on a minute, Shrek 3 is okay.
Oh, that would have upset you, would it?
Yeah, I think it would. Yeah.
Well, what I mean by that is things are going to get much, much worse for Orient during this season. Maybe you could recap for our listeners very swiftly what happened in season 1 and season 2.
Okay. So in the first season of Mr. Bicchetti's reign, we saw him burn through 4 managers, launch a failed reality TV show, and get us relegated to League 2. But by his own standards, Season 2 could be considered a success. We didn't get relegated, and he only burnt through 3 managers. But then again, he did imprison the squad in the hotel for a week. He got fined £40,000 for kicking the assistant manager, Andy Hessentaylor, up the arse, and then was subject to an extradition order from the state of Albania to face charges of fraud.
But none of that compares to what's going to happen in this season, does it? Because let's say Bicchetti completely loses the plot. He tries to put the club out of existence through what I'm going to call a lethal combination of incompetence, spite, and Valpolicella. So buckle up, listeners. This is going to be wild. So before the season started, a very special event happened, which was that Francesco Bicchetti agreed to meet the fans. This was the first time he'd allowed himself to do that. It was a meet the president night that was held at the club. There was a limited number of places. I think there was like about 100 people that were allowed to go. High demand for the tickets. It had to be decided by ballot. I'm pretty sure I must have gone in for the ballot, but I didn't get selected. Were you there, James?
No, I didn't. I didn't go. I don't even remember if I applied to the ballot. I imagine that somebody at the club would have read your blog and so thwarted your attempts to get a ticket that evening.
What I'm thinking is, as soon as they saw yours and my name, they would have thought, we are not going to subject ourselves to the inevitable Jeremy Paxman-style grilling that those two hard-nosed journalists are going to give us. Strike them off the list.
Absolutely.
I also feel potentially I had a lucky escape because I sort of think if you look into Bicchetti's eyes, you might turn into stone. Someone who was there was Andy Gilson, host of the Orient Hour podcast, a much better podcast than this one. And he was co-hosting it with Matt Machowski from E10 Mess podcast, also a better podcast than this one. Weirdly, I spoke to Matt and he has no recollection of this event whatsoever, despite being the co-host of it, which also makes me think if you look directly into Bicchetti's eyes, he may be able to erase your memory. Happily, Andy Gilson did not look directly into his eyes and did remember what happened. So we had a chat with him about it.
It was very strange because Bichetti insisted that all the questions were sent through to him in advance. And then we had to ask the questions on the night as if he didn't already know what some of them were going to be. We gave him he had a wad of paper when he came in, but he did it as if he appeared that he was just flicking through and hadn't really had a chance to see any of the questions. But, I mean, they had already been in advance sent through. So whether he read them or not, I don't know, but he certainly had them in advance. So it was a very, very strange thing because the atmosphere was quite heavy, really, in the room because he turned up with his armed bodyguard. You know, the guy had a pistol inside his jacket. You know, you could see it in the holster. And, so that was, as you do at a football club, you know. And
it seems slightly strange to bring a man with a gun to an evening where you meet the supporters of the football club you own.
I mean, at what point do we say this is not normal? I think we passed that probably a year or two earlier, but yes, bringing an armed bodyguard into a room of football fans for a meet the president evening question and answer is not normal.
Good. So he had a gun. So that obviously made for a sort of friendly, welcoming atmosphere for all the lucky fans that were there. I was quite intrigued to know whether Bichetti came across as charismatic.
No, he wasn't charismatic. I mean, he's quite a... when you've got a armed bodyguard standing next to somebody, you know, it's not a normal situation. It's, you know, you're the president of Orient, not president of the United States, you know. And he's got an armed bodyguard sitting there or standing there. And you think, well, what do you actually expect's going to happen? These are a few football fans want to ask a few questions, you know, and you've got armed people, you know. And it doesn't make for a relaxed atmosphere at all. You know?
He's not charismatic.
No, and I guess if the questions were submitted in advance and then he brought the armed bodyguard, he must really have not liked the questions.
Here's some more of what Andy told us about the night.
He answered some of the questions and he was waffling on about getting in the Premier, saying, why not? We can make the Premier League. I think one or two of the people started buying it, actually, you know, in the audience. You could see that their faces getting, you know, brightening up. And I thought, well, the only Premier League we're getting under this guy is probably the Isthmian Premier League, but some...
Andy Wright in our jokes for us there, James.
Yeah, very frustrating because Isthmian Premier League was my go-to gag and Andy got there first. So
that's one of your best lines.
It is. I mean, I'm pretty much redundant for the rest of the podcast now, so carry on.
Got it. I'll just do the rest of it. It's fine. Let's carry on with Andy.
He got an accusation that somebody raised their hand and said, you've read all these questions, you've rehearsed. And he got hold of all the papers in his hand and he you know, jumped them all together. He went, I have not had the advance notice. And he threw the papers on the table. He said, you ask me anything you want. I will answer anything. He said, he threw these papers on the table. And so a hand went up. He said, yes. He said, why are you murdering this club? And he said, why are you saying I murdered the club? And he said, and this guy, I've forgotten his name there, from the supporters club. You're murdering this club. Why are you saying that? He said, why are you saying that? And his face went red. And you can see he was really angry. And you know, I was sitting there thinking, well, he nearly got out of the building without any badness. And now he's gone mad, you know. And he was furious. And he said, I've put money in. I've paid millions into this club.
I love that. Ask me anything. Why are you murdering the club? What? How dare you?
When the fan asked, why are you murdering this club? I think that's quite restrained, actually, given what had transpired before.
I would not have used the word murder in my question. Given that there was a man with a gun standing next to him.
I mean, that's a very good point.
So helpfully, our friend Jamie Stipe from the Leighton Orienteer fanzine transcribed some of the evening. Actually, no, the whole evening. So I've got some of Bichetti's answers to questions here that I'm just going to read out to you, James, since you weren't there, and get your take on. So firstly, the president was asked, what are your ambitions for the season? He gave a clear answer. League One. No playoffs.
Okay, well, that's ambition. I like it. Yeah, good.
Good, yeah, you're with him so far,
yeah,
aren't you?
So good.
Next, will there be more stability at the club this season? He said he backs every single manager and employee and his house is always open for people who want to speak to him.
Well, I mean, his house is always open for managers to traipse across London to check they're allowed to play the players they wanted to play. So I guess in that respect, yes. And practice managers, he backed them into a corner and then most of them had to leave or resign or kicked out or kicked up the arse. But yeah, okay, let's carry on.
However, he added that if people make mistakes and continue to make mistakes, he said, it's a problem for me. You change your approach to meet important targets.
Sorry, so he's saying that if you keep making mistakes, you should change your approach. So this is the man who hired 10 managers and he's asking people who made mistakes to change their approach. Okay, well, at least he's self-aware. I like that.
Yeah. And this bit is quite interesting. So we've talked a lot about interference in the team, Bichetti having his own view on that. He said this, and I quote, I suggest a lot of the young players, Semedo, Pollock, Sargent, I decide, I select and take these decisions. This is what I change. I'm happy the players come from the academy. I invest. We give the club an asset for the future. This increases the value of the club. I suggest to the manager, it's not my right, but an obligation.
So I'm going to pick the team is what I'm hearing there.
Someone asked him about kicking Hessen Taylor up the arse on Boxing Day. And he simply said, don't question the support. I pretended to kick him.
Well, I'd like to see him really kick him then.
Yeah.
Just a pretend kick.
That was a hefty pretend kick. Someone asked him how come he had burnt through so many managers. He said, like girlfriends, you have to go through a few before you find the right one.
Not sure anyone would go to him for marital advice.
He was asked about his sort of longer term plans. He said he was adamant he should be judged in 4 years, not the two that have just gone past, and that the goal remains the Premier League. He said, this is the game. The money is at the top.
Well, look, when he first came to the club, Barry Hearn promised that he would take us to a new level. And Bichetti did take us to a new level, which is the level we'd never expected to go to. So he did.
So you wanted to do your Isthmian Premier League joke?
No, I'm not doing the Isthmian Premier League gag because Andy Gilson did it.
Because Andy had already used it.
Andy's already done it and I can't go there. I'm not going to do that.
I could see the look of desperation on your face.
I wanted to go to the Isthmian Premier League, but Andy Gilson got there first. And out of respect for Andy Gilson coming onto this podcast and giving an excellent interview, I'm not going to go and copy his Isthmian Premier League gag because it was outstanding.
Last quote, when I have a project, I hit my targets.
Is that in relation to seeing Hessen Taylor and then kicking him up the arse?
He hit that target.
He hit that target, yeah. And Hessen Taylor said it's a hefty target, to be fair.
Right, I think it's time we get on with the football. Can you even remember who was manager at the end of last season?
I don't think anyone even remembers the end of last season. Like, I think it was just such an inconsequential season, wasn't it?
Shall I remind you? It was Andy Hessenthaler was brought in on a caretaker basis. He was the assistant to Kevin Nolan, who in a brilliantly failed ploy by Francesco Bichetti, removed him from manager, asked him to continue as a player, and Kevin Nolan miraculously got injured the next day and never played again. So as we went into the summer, Andy Hessen Taylor was still the caretaker. So there was still an official appointment to be made. Who did Francesco Bichetti appoint as manager going into the 2016-17 season, James?
Andy Hessen Taylor.
That is correct.
Would you believe it?
I was quite surprised by that. Were you?
Yeah, I was. But I think even more surprised now, given that we spoke to Andy at such length in Series 2 and he talked about, you know, he wasn't really sure if he wanted to do the job. And he just sounded like he was doing it out of duty because it was what he did. He loved football. He wanted to be involved. So you've gone from being kicked up the arse in front of the whole stadium and that going viral all over the internet to suddenly being made the permanent manager. It's quite a journey.
Or you could argue that at that point, no one else in football would have taken that job. No one else in any other sport would have taken that job.
I mean, there is that, yeah. And I'm sure he would have been a cheaper option than a lot of other people outside of the club at that point.
I mean, we literally asked Hess exactly that. Why did you take the permanent job?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been asked that question before. Yeah, again, it's just being a football person. Can you get it right and overcome the hurdles in front of you that you've seen since you've been there as an assistant and a caretaker? And the answer is, yeah, I've felt I could, even though it's been turmoil at times. And at times, you know, you're better in the game than out of game. Every manager will say that. When you're out of game, it's tough because it's so competitive now to be in football. So many people want to be in football. So, you know, it's when that's given to you, that opportunity, you got, obviously in the back of my mind was I probably will go. I probably will get the sack in my mind. But I think every manager goes into the job knowing you're probably going to get sacked one day. And, you know, but it, like I said before, all what happened wouldn't have happened if it was run properly and the owners knew the English game. So, but yeah, it's just a case of, look, I've seen a lot go on here. Why am I staying? But I wanted to stay in football and I wanted to, in your mind, I could probably get this. Could I get this right? Could I get this right? But in the end, the interference was never going to happen in the end.
He doesn't sound that enthusiastic about taking the job.
No, and I love how he refers to everything that's happened in the interference as, quote, a couple of hurdles. He loves football. He wants to be in football. It was kind of a free hit. If he had done well, people would have said, wow, that's incredible. You've done so well despite everything that's going on off the field. If he fails, well, no one expected anything different, did they, given what's going on? So
with Hess in the hot seat, there was quite a big turnaround of the squad that summer. Quite a few players left and quite a few players came in. Do you want to talk us through who some of those were?
Yeah, so we said goodbye to some of the players that helped us get to the player final in Matty Baudry, Lloyd James, Joby McAnuff. Of course, he was frozen out for most of his time at Brisbane Road during that first period of with the club he went. And then some of Ian Hendon's failed signings, such as Essam, Turgot, Klahesi, they also made way. But when you look at the players that came in, there was a real decent pedigree there. Liam Kelly came in from Oldham, really, really good reputation. Gavin Massey from Colchester, Robbie Weir from Burton, Jordan Bowery came in, the forward from Oxford, then Tom Parks, Callum Kennedy, two defenders. So when you looked at the squad, it certainly wasn't a squad that would have you looking over your shoulder. You would think there's definitely the opportunity there to push on. In a normal world where everything's being run properly at the club, you'd be looking to go for the playoffs, I imagine. But of course, as we know, nothing's being run properly.
One of the things that we've talked about a lot in the previous two seasons was interference in transfers and player signings and so on. So we wondered whether all of these pretty impressive new signings were all of Hess's signings, given all the interference from the past. So, James, you asked him exactly that.
Andy, that summer then, when you were going to take full charge of the team, how did you prepare? Did you have targets? Were those targets signed by you? Did you have an input on who the club would bring in?
Yeah, I mean, listen, we had a list of players that we started to try and put together, yeah. But obviously, the lad, Rob, can't pronounce his second name. I never really got to the gist of him at times. The goalkeeping coach was doing the recruitment side of it as well, you know. Nice guy, but again, didn't know the English game, but I felt he did. So he came up with quite a few names as well. But don't get me wrong, he was quite good in terms of, you know, the ones that I did bring up to the club, and he did a lot in the negotiation because I, obviously, as a manager, you tend to keep out of that, you know. So it wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad. But obviously, there were names that were being cropped up and players coming in that wasn't on the my radar. So we brought them in and we had a look and, you know, that's what we had.
But some of those players that came in that, obviously, that you weren't aware of way up to standard, and if they weren't, what were you supposed to do with them?
Yeah, some of them wasn't. Well, yeah, I mean, we didn't actually get told we got to, you know, sign them, but it was a case of there was a few coming in that you were almost that wasn't up to the standard, you know. But you know, I couldn't say that. You know, at the end of the day, majority of them, the player, well, all of them, I brought in. So in terms of agreeing on them, so yeah, no. I can't say that it was down to them, down to me as a manager and staff. And, you know, so I've got no real complaints on that.
He didn't sound that sure about that at the end of that clip. I brought in the majority of the players.
He does try and be quite diplomatic, doesn't he? Whenever he doesn't want to do anyone down or do a disservice to anybody, but you could hear the hesitancy in his voice when he's talking about the recruitment there.
So we also spoke to another very important figure at the club. That's Ada Martin, who's been Orient's kit man since the 1990s. Obviously in the dressing room for every single game, close to the players, close to the management. He has an intimate knowledge of the club. So here's what Ada said about what was going on behind the scenes when Andy Hessen-Taylor was appointed manager that pre-season, and in particular around the signing of a French defender called Yves Ericho, who'd previously played just a handful of games for second flight teams in Portugal and Belgium.
Hesse gets it pre-season. He's away on holiday when he gets it, I think. So he phones me out. He goes, "What's going on there?" I went, "Oh, well done on getting the job." He went, "Oh, cheers, thanks a lot. They signing anyone?" He goes, I think they're signing someone called Ericho. Again, it is no uncertain words. You're joking. He's rubbish. I don't want him. And it's like, well, the training ground today and he's signing.
So let me get this straight. The manager had to call you to find out who was being signed.
Yeah, it was funny. It was quite funny. I speak to managers all the time and it's never normally to discuss who's coming in. He goes, What are they doing? And it was the Ericho one. It sticks out by a mile because I was on my hands free in the car driving into the training ground. And you hear these things happening. We got Ericho here today and all that. And you could believe it.
So in addition to some quality signings coming in, one of the themes of this season that we're going to talk about a lot is the quality of some of the youth players that were coming through. And one of those was Michael Clark. 2016-17 was his first season as a pro. And he's a really lovely guy. And we had the chance to talk to him. And the first thing we talked to him about is pre-season tour to Italy. So I assumed Francesco Bocchetti being an Italian man, having lots of connections back into his mother country, that it would be an amazing opportunity for the squad and a young player like Michael Clark and some of the others who just turned pro to go on a tour to another football-loving country, experience the culture. I suspected that would be a really good experience for them. So we asked Michael what that was like.
It was just so boring. We were in the middle of nowhere. I think all that was there was a church and a couple of like local stalls selling like your Catholic rosary beads and things like that. And I think everyone was sort of there like, what are we doing here kind of thing. All that there was to do was train and play cards afterwards. There was no sort of pool to relax in or anywhere to even sit out. It would be train, go back to your room, come back down for dinner, and then back up to your room again, go and play cards. It almost felt like a bit of a prison camp at times because it was, yeah, football and sleep. I remember one instance where Ollie Palmer, we was just out training, warming up, and Ollie Palmer just went and sly tackled the guy, Vito, his name was. It was like Bocchetti's number two, I think. That was probably the highlight of the tour, being honest.
That's a pretty good highlight. Vito has come up in this podcast a few times. He was the chief operating officer. And I can only picture Ollie Palmer of Disney Plus's Road to Wrexham chopping him in half.
Surprised he hit the target, to be honest. But you can tell from Michael Clark's interview there that something wasn't quite right even then on pre-season. It seemed off.
I mean, for God's sake, they could have at least taken them to a pizza restaurant.
If you're going to go to Italy,
come on.
Pizza and gelato is a must. And given what was going to happen anyway that season, they might as well have gone all out.
Pasta alla vongole.
I love the pronunciation.
That was bad, wasn't it? Anyway, kitman Ada Martin was also on that pre-season tour, and here's what he remembers.
Yeah, that was a shambles, that was. I think it was based in a place called Cascia. And the sad part is, remember the earthquake in Italy that destroyed quite a few cities? That was one of them. And the hotel was terrible. It was really, really bad. It was a really, really bad trip. And you can see the new players who just signed thinking, what have we walked to here? They're on a downer straight away. There's nothing you can really do to pull them up, you know. They thought they were coming to a decent club. And my thing to them was, you've come to the right club at the wrong time. You know, you like to think that we're going to be promoted at the end of the season, all that. But in your heart of hearts, you knew after that trip and the organisation and that, that it weren't going to be great. It weren't going to be great.
Right, let's get into the season. What happened in the first game, James?
So, started with a 1-1 draw with Cheltenham. We lost the next game at home to Newport, but then beat Stevenage 3-1 at home.
At that home victory versus Stevenage, someone who we talked about quite a lot in the last season was Linda Hendon, wife, now ex-wife, sadly, of manager number 5 in Bocchetti's reign, Ian Hendon. And Linda, if you'll recall, was very active on Twitter. And after that victory against Stevenage, she popped up again on Twitter claiming that she and Ian had actually been banned from Brisbane Road. This is her tweet. If you recall last time, I very lazily did not bother to find out where Linda was from. So I got one of my friends to voice it in a Essex accent. In between season 2 and season 3, I still haven't bothered to find out where she's from. So this time I've got a different friend to voice it in a Geordie accent. And let's hope one of them's correct. Here's what Linda said.
Ian Hendon and I have been informed by Bocchetti that we are not welcome at Brisbane Road to support Orient or Hess. Hashtag complete clown of a chairman.
Now, when season 2 came out and we talked about Linda Hendon, someone got in touch with us. That was Elliot Byrne, who at the time was an 18-year-old Orient fan, but in later years went on to actually become Orient's media manager. Anyway, as I say, at the time, Elliot was 18 and he had his own encounter with Linda, and we felt it was important to hear that story. So we talked to Elliot, and this is what he said.
I used to write for one of the local papers, I think it was the Guardian series. They'd invited me to, I think, along with a few other supporters, write a few kind of fan-based columns. And I wrote a few columns and gave my opinion, some of which were somewhat critical of Ian Hendon and the team at the time, and I think my first interaction with her was when she responded to one of the articles that I'd written, and she called me the most unintelligent fan on Twitter. But I don't remember being too upset with it. It was, I'd given my opinion. She was perfectly entitled to give her opinion. I didn't necessarily agree with the sentiment, but
sure.
She's totally able to. I think I just wrote a few more articles here and there. It must have been every couple of months, maybe. And I remember we played Scunthorpe in the FA Cup, and the game was the FA Cup replay. The second day, we obviously had drawn Chelsea in the next round at Stamford Bridge, and I remember just the performance was particularly disappointing, and I was asked to write another column. And I think, having had interactions with her, I genuinely tried to make it less about Ian Hendon, the manager, and more about the group as a collective. I felt it was fair to be critical, but I didn't want to single him out per se. And she took further liberty to that and started messaging me on Twitter and essentially just said, would you come and meet Ian Hendon and for a chat? And I must have been about 18 at the time. And I thought, well, I can't criticize him in the papers and then not, you know, front up about it. And so I said, yeah, I'll happily meet him. And then the meeting itself, I think it was before a game against Yeovil, I want to say. And I was told to meet him at the underground car park at the stadium about 1 o'clock.
Who told you to meet him there?
It was all via Linda.
No one from the club was involved in this at all?
No, I don't.
There's some serious safeguarding issues around that. But anyway.
I don't think they were aware, bless them. And so I head to this underground car park. And,
were you scared?
Yeah. When I arrive, I'm telling the steward that I've got a meeting with the manager. Quite understandably, he doesn't believe a word I'm saying. But Ian's standing there in the car park waiting for me. And it's quite a long walk. He's just outside the tunnel area. It's quite a long walk across the car park to the tunnel area. I thought, oh, I don't know if this is a good idea. I couldn't work out from his face whether how angry with me he was. But yeah, got across to him. He was perfectly pleasant in all seriousness. He was, he shook my hand. He took me into the little coach's office. Obviously, all the preparations for the game were going on around us. And he essentially just sat down and went, ask whatever you want. And so I did for about, I want to say about 20 minutes. I just grilled him on why he'd made certain decisions and why he had done certain things. And I can't remember any specifics in terms of what was said, but I remember him seeming like he was, you know, he was being open and honest. And it was quite, in a weird way, quite an enjoyable 20 minutes getting to sit down with the manager of football club and listen to him explain, you know, why he was doing the things he was doing. It was a useful perspective to gain. But yeah, I'm not sure the club knew that it was happening. I'm not sure they were, I can't imagine they were best pleased about him meeting an 18-year-old fan an hour and a half before kickoff.
Absolutely extraordinary story, isn't it?
That isn't normal, is it?
No, it's not normal. And you can hear Elliot obviously was quite daunted. Meet Ian Hendon in the underground car park at 1 o'clock. I mean,
I don't know why, but I've got a picture of like Hendon at the other end of the car park in a trench coat and a trilby smoking.
The whole way that story unfolded is a bit creepy to me.
Right, let's get back to 2016-17. So one further win and another loss in August meant that after five games, Orient were in 10th place with 7 points from five games, which isn't really that great and definitely was not what Francesco Bacchetti was aspiring to when he agreed to sign all those quality players coming in. We have to remember that these players were operating in what was still, so it seems, a very sort of chaotic environment. And we talked in the previous seasons a lot about the interference on the training ground, Bacchetti himself arriving there. So we asked Michael Clark what it was like in that season. And
it'd just be drama. Some sort of drama each week. There's always something going on. Training starting later than it should have been because Bacchetti wanted to drive out of London and he couldn't do that in rush hour in the mornings.
Would he come into every training session?
Most of them, yeah. You'd see his Bentley and his driver. Yeah, that was kind of how you knew that he was there.
What was he doing when he was there?
I couldn't tell you. Just having his presence there, I suppose.
But was he standing on the touchline?
I think he would have come out a couple of times if the weather permitted. if not, he'd be sitting sort of where we'd eat, yeah. And just being there. He might speak to a few players. His driver's son actually came and trained with us for about half of that season. He wasn't a great player, but I'm guessing it was just a case of this kid's training with you. And they were like, fine. Another thing, we had a new sort of chef come in, but Bacchetti and his staff would get their food first. And us as a youth team would be fed last. And we're used to just having like a buffet, help yourself to your chicken, your rice. And now we're sitting down at the table waiting for food. That was strange. Almost trying to turn a clubhouse into a restaurant just because he's there. And I know it was a dreadful time for the club and for fans, but it was just laughable how ridiculous it all was.
Oh yeah, the driver's son he can play. Start him on Saturday.
Can he play up front? We need a striker.
He may have done better than Gianvito Plasmati, to be fair.
More difficult.
At the end of that month, Orient had a home game in Johnson Paint Trophy, as it was called at the time, against Stevenage. So there's quite a story behind this, and it concerns Dean Cox. Who's Dean Cox, James?
So Dean Cox was, I suppose, a bit of a club legend, you would say now. Diminutive winger, scorer of fantastic goals, brilliant assists, was a key part of the team that got to the League One playoff final, and was Orient through and through. Fans' favourite. Everyone loved him. Had a really bad injury in the previous season, but was back in business and looking good. And we were hoping this was going to be the season that he'd get back to his best.
So turning up to that Johnson's Paint Trophy game, and the first person Dean meets when he arrives is the kit man, Ada Martin. And I'm going to let Dean Cox himself take up the story. This is actually from an interview that he did with our friend Dave Victor on the Orient Hour podcast. So I'm very grateful to them for loaning us this interview. This is what Dean said.
First thing, I walked in a tank room, actually, and Ada's there. He sort of gave me a funny look, and I was thinking, oh, what's wrong? So I've got here, and then my shirt's not up there. Something. Yesterday, I was in the 11, so I've gone from that to not being in a squad. So something must be up. And I just remember Andy Hesketh saying, look, Cox, you need to go and speak to the chairman. I said, okay. I said, where is it? And he said, oh, he's upstairs. So I said, okay, I'll go and see him. And I remember walking in, Dave, there's a massive table, and there's Vito. Can't remember what was goalkeeping coach's name at the time, Dave.
Bob Degliani.
Yeah, he was there. And
Alessandro
and Francesco. All sitting at the table. So I walk in, and Francesco said, I'll take a seat. I said, no, I'm all right, I'll stand. So I stood. I said, just been sent up, what? Is everything okay? And he said, no, it's not okay. We want you to leave. And I said, well, I've only just come back from injury. I said, I've been out for 8 months with a, you know, I'm ready to go. I want to, you know. And he said, no, you've got to go. Your two options are, you go to Northampton, you sign there today, you go there straight from here, or if you stay, you will train with the youth team for the remainder of your contract and you won't be part of the first team plan right up to the end of your contract. So obviously, you can imagine I was stunned. I couldn't believe what was been said. So I thought, I did take a seat, Dave, I must admit. I sat down and I just said, where's this all come from? No, it doesn't matter where it's come from. We don't want you here at the football club. You have to leave. And obviously, Dave, at the time, I was going through a divorce, which a lot of people don't know, but I was going through a divorce with my ex-wife. So I had a lot of stress, Dave. I was already down. And obviously, with this being thrown in, my only get out was playing football. And they were trying to take it away from me. So you can imagine the emotions. So I remember saying to them, I'm not leaving. I said, I won't be going to Northampton. I don't want to go there. So I remember them saying to me, well, okay, you need to tell us how much of your contract you want and we will pay you to go. So I thought, okay, well, whatever. So obviously I lost my head a little bit, Dave. So I walked out of the room, composed myself. I rang my parents and they just advised me to go home. So I got on the train, Dave, from Leighton. I'll get to London Bridge and I get a call from Vito saying, can I come back? We want it sorted now. I said, no, I'm going home to my parents. I said, I'll speak to you later. And I hung up the phone, Dave. So I get on the train and get home. Just wanted to get myself away from the situation, Dave. It's with me. So a couple of days at home. Sorry, no, not a couple of days because it was on the transfer. So I got home. And I remember having six missed calls, Dave, from Big Five. They really wanted to get this done. So obviously the financials was what it was. Obviously, the where they had me, Dave, is they done it after the transfer window, as you well know. We had all agreed by 10 o'clock, but they had an hour to get the paperwork in, and obviously didn't. So again, I was then still at home. They told me they didn't want me to go to the training ground, so I couldn't even say bye to the players. So I remember just being at home, and obviously going through my divorce as well, Dave. At the time, I was in a bad place, if I'm honest. So, you know, we along with my parents, they said, look, if you stay, it's going to make your life a misery. And, you know, what I was going through at the time was already hard enough. Obviously, if he'd said that I'd be involved in the first team, and, you know, I would have stayed, Dave. You know me. There's no way I would have left that football club. I really felt I was pushed against the wall, really, if I'm honest. And I had to come to the decision, and obviously because it was after the transfer window, it put another. If I left, I obviously then couldn't sign for a club till the following January, which obviously left me in limbo. And that was, I mean, the decision. Like I said, the decision of that, obviously looking after myself financially, along with losing my football club that I absolutely adored. Literally just come back from being 9 months out, Dave, with a knee ligament injury. And obviously the divorce with my ex-wife. So it was a lot on my plate at the time. And if I'm honest, the only reason I left was because it was a less stress in my head to have to deal with. I knew I was financially okay. And I come home and I was, I pretty much moved back with my parents, Dave, at the time because I needed to be with someone. So it was really emotional time. I remember going to the ground. I remember crying with Ada on the pitch and saying bye. Cause obviously I had to go through this, just the, they allowed me to the stadium because I had to sign the paperwork. Yeah, I think that was the worst day of my life that day, if I'm honest. The walk around, last walk around the pitch, where, you know, I had absolutely adored my time and would give any, you know, I'd give anything to play one more game on that pitch.
Heartbreaking, isn't it, to listening to that interview? Absolutely heartbreaking. Utterly bewildering, really, when you look back at it. He was someone who was so adored by the fans, who had given so much to the club, had been part of that fabulous team, so many special moments, so many wonderful goals. And to see somebody like that treated so abysmally is utterly heartbreaking, but also speaks to the wider picture of just how badly run the club was at that time. Just horrendous.
Yeah, absolutely. Once that had happened, the club released a statement which simply said this: Dean Cox has left the club by mutual consent. We'd like to thank Dean for his service to the club and wish him all the best for the future. Here's what Dean said about that statement.
The regret is that it ended the way it did, Dave. You know, I pleaded with them that I could put out a nice statement or speak to someone about it, but I couldn't. It wasn't able to happen for whatever reason, Dave. It got slightly bitter on their end, which disappointed me, with obviously the statement that the club put out, which was probably the least amount they could do. You know, it was a chore for them even to put that out, I think, at the time.
So as you say, James, like, he was treated absolutely despicably. Like, he was a club legend, and I think there was a lot more to that decision by Bichetti. We've talked a bit about Bichetti himself wanting to be adored by the fans, and like, he wasn't, but Dean Cox was. Like, and I think there's an element of spite, of jealousy, of many things there. But to force him out of the club and not even allow him the scenario where he'd go and sign for any other Football League club, I just thought was a really spiteful thing to do.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Matt. Just absolutely outrageous behaviour. And that statement, I love how it says mutual consent. I don't think that's quite true, is it? And the fact that he wasn't allowed to say goodbye, and I just think it's disgraceful. Just disgraceful. And it's a real shame for Dean to have left that way, because he should have gone out on such a high with all the adoration that he deserved from the fans. And at that point, you know, if Dean Cox had left and gone to another club and because he wanted to go, fair enough. But he didn't want to go. He wanted to be at Orient. It was his club. He's got a big heart, Dean Cox. Very big heart. And he really really affected him what happened under Bichetti. I feel really sorry for him. He gave us so much joy, and he made so many people smile, and to see him forced out like that is just horrible.
So you have to wonder why Bichetti was quite so dead set on him leaving, and why he did it in such a spiteful way. And I wonder if it was anything to do with this incident that Dean talked about that happened a couple of seasons before.
I remember once he asked me to go to his house. Things were going really bad, so he wanted to see an experienced player. And I got a phone call to say, could I go to his house? So I got the tube down to Oxford Street, and he lived at the back of Mayfair, as it was quite well documented. And I remember going to his house, and he was asking me what I thought. I took my agent with me, just in case anything was going to happen. It was a bit daunting, if I'm honest. So he said I could bring my agent. So we were sitting there, Dave, and he just asked me a few questions. And the way he spoke and the question, what's going wrong then? I remember that was his first question, Dave. What's going wrong then? And I remember saying to him, do you want the truth, or do you want me to make something up? No, the truth. I said, well, you're running this club into the ground and you need to get fans back on side. You need to do things properly. You need to be informative. You need to be engaging. You need to help the manager. Don't hinder him. I mean, he used to turn up and pick the team days. I think that was quite well documented, and it's true. And I remember him coming back and saying, well, I own the club, so what I do goes. I said, well, listen, you've asked me to come and see you. You've asked my honest opinion. I'm giving you it.
I've always liked that about Cox. He says it how it is. There's no sugarcoating it. Becchetti had a lot of yes men, as we know. Perhaps he didn't like to hear the unvarnished truth.
Cox spoke the truth to power, and power didn't like it. So we've talked a bit about how we felt about that. I think we weren't alone in that. I think it was a real turning point for any fans who were still giving Becchetti at least some benefit of the doubt. And I know certainly my friend who sits behind me where my season ticket is didn't come to another game after the Cox announcement until Becchetti had sold the club. He was so outraged by it. And yeah, I think he probably wasn't alone in that. So behind the scenes and in the next couple of episodes, we're going to hear lots more about this. Fans were starting to mobilise, and a lot of that was centred around the Leyton Orient Fans Trust and some of their activities. And we spoke to Tom Davies, who is the vice chair of Loft and I think their media liaison officer, on his feelings around Cox being ousted out of the club in that manner.
When Dean Cox was elbowed out of the club, the final scales fell from most people's eyes about what sort of what we were dealing with. Really, you know, it was very obvious at that point that there was a sick club that was in a serious malaise at that point.
And since it's now become our tradition to end every episode on the lowest note possible, that is about it for this one.
I mean, it does get better, doesn't it, Matt?
No.
Fair enough.
It gets much, much worse. But we're going to hear more from Tom. We are. I don't want to give it away, but Hess doesn't last much longer. I don't think that's going to be a big surprise to anyone, but you're all going to be very excited about the quality of the manager that was brought in to follow him up. So we're going to talk about that in the next episode. For the moment, James, thanks for joining me for this one.
It's lovely to be back, Matt.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's been a while.
We've missed it.
The never-ending podcast.
It's just nice. It's nice and nostalgic, isn't it? Like a comfy blanket during a cold winter.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you for the next episode.
Arrivederci.